Hello, thank you. It's always nice to have a clear announcement. I've been going through a bit of an identity crisis recently. A couple of years ago, I started a book tour in Cleethorpes. The mayor very kindly introduced me. He said, "One person who needs no introduction from me is Mr. Nick Sheridan." Easily understandable one was getting out of a taxi at World's End, and after I'd tipped the guy, he said, "Go on, tell us your name." I said, "Ned Sheridan." He said, "Oh, thank Christ. I was going to tell the wife I had that Patrick Moore in the back of my cab." Another terrible area of danger is Broadcasting House. I was going into Broadcasting House the other day, and one of those dispatch riders, dressed rather like a deep-sea diver with a great diver's bell over his head, came out, and he got very excited. He said, "Oh, gug, 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 gug." So I said, "Put up your visor." He took off his helmet and said, "How are your two sons?" I said, "I don't have any sons. I've got two very nice nephews who live in Somerset." He said, "You are Desmond Wilcox, aren't you?" Privileged enough to have discovered Esther Ranson without being accused of marrying her. Now, I gather most people in this series have been milling over their lives. Well, for the last 3 or 4 weeks, I've been rehearsing a new musical, A Saint She Ain't, by Dick Vosper and Dennis King. So I haven't had time to research my life. So I thought I'd concentrate on one of my hobbies. For some reason, I've never put collecting theatrical anecdotes down as one of my hobbies in Who's Who. But it has yielded me a couple of books, a talking tape, and a sort of one-man show. To remember them, I arranged them alphabetically from A to Z, Geoffrey Archer to Pier Zadora. Lord Archer of Weston-super-Mare, the only seaside pier on which Danny LaRue has not performed. They're not the sort of stories that go, "Then the scenery fell down and Joyce forgot her words, my how we laughed." They're more those that spring from the drama, the tension, the gossip and the wit that are inevitable during the hothouse build-up to a theatrical performance. Half the fun of collecting anecdotes is trying to authenticate who said them in what context and what the exact words were. In the theatre, tales of drink and examples of wit tend to be handed down from generation to generation and then ascribed to suitable drunken or witty candidates. Take the oldest chestnut of all, I suppose, a story that I'm sure many of you know. Two Shakespearean actors, they were playing in Richard III, and they were both great topers. So they had a very liquid lunch before the matinee, and they staggered to the theatre, and the curtain rose. One was playing Richard III, the other was playing the Duke of Buckingham. Curtain rose as Richard III tottered down to the footlights, said, "Now is the winter of our discontent." Little voice in the gallery said, "You're drunk." He said, "You think I'm drunk? Wait till you see the Duke of Buckingham." Now, one tends to think that the true version of a story is the way one first heard it. And I first heard that told about two wonderful actors and drinking actors, Robert Newton and Wilfred Lawson. But when I started researching the book, I find that neither Newton nor Lawson had ever appeared in any production of Richard III, certainly not as Richard and as Buckingham. So Cedric Hardwick, in his autobiography, puts it somewhere in the 19th century. Peter O'Toole, in his wonderful first volume of autobiography, thinks it's two 18th century tragedians, Keen and Cook, but there's no real justification for that. I suspect it goes way back into the mists of time. It's similar with stories of wit. Practically every theatrical anecdote may get prefaced with the name of Noel Coward because it creates a sort of expectancy in the audience. And certainly a lot of the extra verses of Eskimo Nell and many of the dirtiest limericks have been quite unfairly ascribed to Coward. The story that I loved or found fascinating tracing was one which goes back to the coronation of the Queen. Looking round, I can see not many people here are old enough to remember the coronation of the Queen. But it was a damp day, and there was this huge coronation procession, and the enormous Queen Saloti of Tonga made a point of riding in an open carriage where many people had covered their carriages. Anyway, she was determined that she would wave to the crowd and be seen. And sitting opposite her, not so pleased about it, was the tiny little Sultan of Kelantan. And as the procession went by, on one balcony, Noel Coward was watching, and somebody nudged him and said, "Who's that little man sitting opposite Queen Saloti?" And Coward said, "Her lunch." He always denied this story. He said it was in very bad taste. He was a great friend of Queen Saloti, and she would have been very upset if it had ever got back to her. So that's what I put in the first edition. Then I immediately got a letter from excellent actor John Moffat saying that he'd been in a play with Coward at the Haymarket at the time of the coronation. And he and another actor, Hugh Manning, had been standing on the steps of the stage door when Coward arrived for the evening performance. And one of them said, who was that little man sitting opposite Queen Saloti? And Coward said to them, her lunch. So I had to change it for the next edition. Then I bumped into Coward's lifelong companion, Graham Payne, and told him what difficulty I'd had authenticating the story. And Graham said, oh, it wasn't Noel at all. No, it wasn't Noel. It was David Niven who said it was Noel who asked the question, and David Niven who said her lunch. So we can't be absolutely sure with any of these stories. There was a curious postscript to that. I was doing a Duke of Edinburgh's award luncheon sometime afterwards, and I told this story, and as I was getting to it, I suddenly saw the Duke on the top table waving. I thought, you're not going to interrupt me when I'm in full flood. We'll find out what this is all about afterwards. So I said afterwards, why were you waving during the Queen Saloti story? He said, it was absolutely incredible. He said, we had Britannia off the coast of Malaya a couple of years after the coronation. We had all these sultans on board. We had a very convivial evening. And later in the evening, I said, come on, which of you was her lunch? And then... And they all screamed with laughter and pointed to the little Sultan of Kelantan, who stood up and said, yes, me, I was her lunch. So we don't know who originally said it, but we do know it went round the world quite quickly. It's the same in sport. There's a story I've been trying to authenticate at Lord's for some time, and because they're always so shifty about it, I'm inclined to think it might be true. A couple of seasons ago, during a test match, Sebastian Coe, the great middle-distance runner, had an invitation to one of those hospitality boxes at Lord's, and he arrived a little bit late and at the wrong gate. So he proffered his ticket to one of the club servants. Anybody who goes to Lord's will know how rude the club servants at Lord's can be. They took one look at the ticket and said, wrong gate, go around the other gate. And he said, but you don't understand, I'm late, I'm terribly keen on cricket, it's very rude to my hosts, I've missed a couple of overs, I'm dying to get in, please let me in. Wrong gate, go around the other gate. He made that fatal mistake of drawing himself up to his medium height and saying, don't you know who I am? No. I am Sebastian Coe. Right, you'll be able to run round the other gate all the quicker, won't you? Let's get back to the theatrical anecdotes. We can't do all the 26 letters in what's left of 30 minutes, but let's start with the letter A. And wonderful old Shakespearean actor Robert Atkins, who was with the Old Vic when it was started and started the open-air theatre in Regent's Park with Sidney Carroll. And towards the end of his life, Robert was admitted to hospital. I know this one's true because I got it from his son, Ian. Anyway, Robert, very old man, sent into hospital, but determined, being a true professional, to keep his vocal cords loosened and exercised. And so he did all his vocal exercises and would reel off yards of Shakespeare to the amusement of other people in the ward. And then one day the matron came up to him and said, excuse me, Mr. Atkins, but you see that screen around that bed there? Well, that's a very old gentleman behind that screen, and he's very ill, and we don't think he's going to last even the night. And he has asked if you would mind stopping your Shakespearean recitations. They're getting on his nerves. Of course I understand, my dear. I will desist, said Robert. And the matron went away happy, and the next thing the old boy behind the screen knew was Robert's leonine head had come round the corner and said, I hear you don't like Shakespeare. I also hear you are about to meet him. Under the bees, there's a wonderful American critic and member of the Algonquin Round Table, Robert Benchley, who was forced to go and see a play called Abby's Irish Rose, which ran for 4 or 5 years, and he'd have to go back and check on the new cast periodically. And he got so bored with this that one time he came back and his report on Abby's Irish Rose in the critical column simply read, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8. I'm sure most of you will be able to pick up that reference, but for those of you who can't, it simply reads, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. The great queen of theatrical quotations in the latter part of this century has been a wonderful, exotic Australian actress, Coral Brown. She was in a classic Old Vic production of Midsummer Night's Dream. Frankie Howard played Bottom, and I think she played Helena. And the very first day of rehearsals, they did what actors normally do, sit down round a table to read the play. And Coral was sitting chatting to a nice actor called David Dodemead, and suddenly he saw that he'd lost her attention, and her eyes had strayed to the door where a particularly handsome young actor was coming in. And she nudged him and said, "Oh, I rather fancy that." And he said, "I don't think you'll have any luck there, Coral. I don't think he's playing on your team." And she said, "Wanna bet?" And so they wagered £1 that she would take him home that night. And then they went through the reading and then the first bit of rehearsal, and David was rather dimmed to see the two of them leaving arm in arm and thought he'd lost his quid. However, the next morning, Coral came straight across to him, bolted straight across to him and said, "I owe you 17 shillings and sixpence." We're on the seas. We've done one Noel Coward story. We can't really let Coward go without a couple more. We used to share a doctor, a nice man called Patrick Woodcock, and Coward came to see Patrick one day, and Patrick was complaining that he, the doctor, was beginning to have lapses of memory and rather pompously called them lacunae. And ever after that, whenever Coward bumped into him, he always used to say, "Ah, here comes the lily of lacunae." He had an accountant back in the 30s who he thought had lost him a lot of money. And he sacked him long ago, but much later somebody came and said, "Do you know that accountant who used to work for you? He's blown his brains out." And Card said, "I'd no idea he was such a good shot." One that I have had authenticated by Richard Olivier, Laurence Olivier's son, by Joan Plowright. The Oliviers used to live on Royal Crescent in Brighton, just up the road from the great Centre for the Blind, St Dunstan's. And Richard Olivier was Coward's penultimate godson. And Coward came down to see the Oliviers one day and to see his little godson, Richard. So he took the little boy out for a walk along the front at Brighton. And they were having a sort of nice godfather-godson sort of chat when suddenly Card saw that he'd lost the little boy's attention and looked down, and there were two dogs which are doing what I can only refer to on Radio 4, I suppose, as making love in the gutter. And the little boy was absolutely fascinated by this, looked up at his godfather and said, "Uncle Noel, what are those two dogs doing?" Card thought very quickly and said, "One of them is blind and the other one is pushing him the entire way to St Dunstan's." under leaping to E, we've got Dame Edith Evans, who used to live in Albany, nearly opposite Fortnum and Mason's. And during the war, when there was a blockade and submarines and no exotic fruit got into the country, Dame Edith went into Fortnum's one day and was amazed and delighted to see a pineapple. So she said, "I'll have that." And they wrapped up the pineapple and she proffered a pound note. Wasn't best pleased when she found that they charged 17 and sixpence, and she only got 2 and 6 change. So she looked down her nose, took the pineapple, and said, "Keep the change! I trod on a grape on the way in." Under the G's, I'm very fond of a letter Jill Gascoigne told me she got once. It's one of those awful poison pen letters which sort of spews bile and insult and innuendo, usually lots of underlinings and different coloured inks. And we all know that we shouldn't read through these letters, but they have a poisonous fascination about them. And Jill ploughed through this list of insults, but was rather pleased she had at the end, because at the bottom it said, "P.S. If undelivered, please forward to Jenny Agutter." You can't tell theatrical anecdotes without including John Gielgud. I'm always reluctant because I'm one of the few people who can't really imitate Sir John's voice, and every proper actor can. He is, of course, famous for dropping bricks, which are affectionately known as Gielgudies. The classic one goes back to the 20s when he was having lunch in the Ivy restaurant with a playwright called Edward Knobloch. He wrote the play on which the musical Kismet was eventually based. But Edward Knobloch's great reputation was being a thundering bore. And Ilga was lunching with him, and he suddenly saw the door of the Ivy open and another even bigger bore coming through the door. So he looked away quickly because he didn't want to attract the man's attention. He prayed that Knobloch wouldn't catch his eye and he wouldn't come and join them so he'd be surrounded by bores. And they were lucky. The other man went on, found his table and didn't notice them. And Sir John heaved a sigh of relief, turned round to his host and said, "Oh, thank God you didn't catch his eye. He's an even bigger bore than Eddie Knobloch." And he was still doing it in the 60s. A friend of mine in the 60s was having lunch at a table next to an actor who is still with us, so we'll call him Walter Plinge. And Gielgud came into the restaurant, passed my friend's table and Walter Plinge's table in a great hurry, and then sort of stopped, hesitated, turned and came back and said to Walter Plinge, "I'm so sorry, I thought you were that terrible actor, Walter Plinge. Oh, my God, so you are, I'm terribly sorry." First night of O Calcutta was memorable for Robert Helpman, saying the trouble with nude dancing is that not everything stops with the music. Very sweet and talented actress, you'll all remember, certainly from A Brief Encounter, Celia Johnson. Curious thing about Celia Johnson, she was a natural actress of great talent, but she didn't really value her talent for acting. She thought that the most important thing in life, and who should say that she was wrong, was being a wife and mother and looking after the family. In fact, the impresario Binky Beaumont always used to say, "You can never get Celia to take a part unless she needs a new set of curtains." She had a great success with Wilfred Hyde White in The Reluctant Debutante by William Douglas Hume. And the producers said, "You know, we've got this one part, this actor. We can't seem to think of the right actor." And she said, "Well, it's absolutely perfectly obvious. You must have Jack Merivale." And they said, "Jack Merivale, we don't think we know his work. Is he a good actor?" And she said, "Well, I don't know about that, but he can certainly drop me off on Henley Bridge every night after the performance." That's getting the values about right, I think. I'm very fond of a singer, actress, dancer called Chrissy Kendall. We worked together on the musical OK at Chichester. And one of the most attractive things about Chrissy is that she's a champion malapropper. She's been heard to express her appreciation for the acting skill of Joan Playwright. Tallulah Bankhead has been metamorphosed into Tallulah Handbag and Tallulah Bunk Bed. She thought at one time that she would take acting more seriously, and she was advised to read Stanislavski. She asked her friend Annette how Stanislavski was spelt, and Annette began S-T-A-N. "Oh, I know how to spell his first name," she said. Under the M's also, we've got Eric Mashvitz. Now, we're in a BBC situation here, and Eric Mashvitz is a remarkable man. He was the head of BBC Radio Light Entertainment in the 30s, and in the late 50s and early 60s, he was the head of BBC Television Light Entertainment. But he was also a very distinguished lyric writer. He wrote the words for "A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square," Room 504, and "These Foolish Things." And he also wrote a musical called Goodnight Vienna, which had a great success in the West End and then was filmed with Jack Buchanan and Anna Neagle. And I always like telling this story because it's often mistold and they get the place and the person it concerns and everything wrong. And Eric told me this himself, so it's nice to put it on record for him. He was coming back from the coast in his car once and he was driving through Lewisham. And he saw at Lewisham Hippodrome that they were advertising a touring production of Goodnight Vienna. So he thought, oh, it'd be rather nice to go in and see the old show, see how it's going. So he stopped the car, skipped up the steps and said to the commissioner, "How's Goodnight Vienna doing in Lewisham?" And the commissioner said, "About as well as you'd expect Goodnight Lewisham to do in Vienna." There's a wonderful American character actress, Sylvia Miles, who specialised in Tennessee Williams plays. She was also in the orgy scene in Midnight Cowboy. But anyway, one day she was walking down the sidewalk in New York with Tennessee Williams, and suddenly he stopped her and said, "Sylvia, look at that woman on the other sidewalk. She's so thin." And Sylvia Miles looked across, "Oh, Tennessee, that's anorexia nervosa." And Tennessee said, "Sylvia, my dear, you know everybody." There is a London hostess who says that Tennessee went through exactly the same motions with her, so I suspect he may have gone around looking for thin women and gullible companions, but I like to let it stay with Sylvia Miles. Under M also, there's My Fair Lady. It's difficult to remember now what the excitement was when My Fair Lady first came here from Broadway. It had been running there for a couple of years, and the excitement had built up and built up. I can't remember before or since quite such excitement generated by a first night. You can judge how keen people were for tickets by the fact that burglars would go out and buy absurdly over the cost price tickets from scalpers, and then just carefully check out their victims, send them a couple of tickets, know that they would be out of the house on that evening, and then just go in and clean up. It was that sort of fervour for the tickets. A friend of mine was working as a front of house manager there, and about 6 months into the run, he was patrolling the dress circle, looking down, and he suddenly, horror of horrors, saw an empty seat down in the stalls. And he thought, is this the beginning of, you know, the attendance tailing off? It's too late. The orchestra was about to strike up the overture. Too late for him to get down and check. So he positioned himself outside the stalls when the interval came, dashed in, luckily found the seat still empty and the woman sitting still beside it, and said, I'm terribly sorry, madam, this is really a bit of an imposition on your privacy, but, you know, we've had such an exciting 6 months here and we haven't had a single empty seat. I just wonder, is there an explanation for the empty seat next to you? And she said, well, there is, actually, and I'm afraid it's very sad. My husband and I had been looking forward so much to My Fair Lady. In fact, we wrote off for tickets the moment they went on sale. And we were so excited when we got them, and we've been really looking forward to it. But unfortunately, my husband died. And the chap said, I'm so sorry, madam. I shouldn't have brought it up. Started to go away again, thought he couldn't really leave this bone unchewed. So he came back again and said, madam, I'm awfully sorry, but couldn't you have asked a friend? She said, no, they're all at the funeral. There's a sort of classic run of overheards in the theatre, things that you overhear either in the interval or as people come out, or sometimes you can even hear them from the stage. I expect it goes back to the beginning of time. The definitive, really old one, it happened in Queen Victoria's reign when Sarah Bernhardt came over and gave a very tempestuous performance as Cleopatra, and two Knightsbridge ladies were heard going out, and one said to the other, how very unlike the home life of our own dear queen. I went to Chichester to see a performance of the same play, Antony and Cleopatra, with Sir John Clements and Margaret Leighton. And going across the car park afterwards, on that occasion, I heard one Sussex lady turn to the other one and say, something very similar happened to Monica. Coming out of Dr. Jonathan Miller's production of Three Sisters, I was behind two American matrons, and they, I think, hadn't been too impressed by Chekhov's Three Sisters. One turned to the other and said, more a play than a show, wasn't it? There was a great sensation at Stratford when Peter Brook produced Titus Andronicus with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. And as you know, it's that most bloodthirsty of Shakespeare's plays. People's limbs are cut off, a young woman's tongue is cut out, her arms are cut off, two boys are slain, chopped up and baked in a pie and fed to their mother. It's one of those light little early Shakespearean pieces. And my friend Martin Tickner swears that he was going across the car park after that, and he caught two county types going towards their Land Rover, and the husband turned to the wife and said, all we need to find out now is that the dog's been sick in the back of the car. Now, some time ago we did a program of Stephen Sondheim songs called Side by Side by Sondheim with Millicent Martin, Julia McKenzie and David Kernan, and I had to simply sit on the side of the stage and sort of try and, not difficult with Sondheim songs, make a few jokes to show how relevant they were to modern day life. And I always remember one matinee when David Kernan was singing very sweetly one of Sondheim's prettiest and quietest ballads. One old lady just down in front of me turned to her companion and said, oh look! Turnips are coming back. when we took it, when we took Side by Side to America, it was all right for Millie and Julia and David. They just carried on singing exquisitely the 2 hours worth of Sondheim songs that they'd been singing in London. I had to slightly change my stuff because I suppose in London at that period, it would have been 1976, you only had to say Mary Whitehouse or Jeremy Thorpe to get a good laugh. Well, those names don't travel across the Atlantic, so I had it translated by a nice American called Tony Geis, and just when I thought I was beginning to get on top of it and on top of this new material, and the Americans were beginning to laugh, I got, I suppose, a bit cocky. And so I was so pleased with the way that it went one night that I rushed out of the theatre afterwards to go to Charlie's bar next door for a couple of large vodka martinis. And I was so keen to get there that I tripped arse over tip down the steps of the music box on 45th Street and landed flat on my back in the gutter. And the patrons were still coming out. The audience was still coming out, and so I lay there looking up at the stars, and they went past, and two young men whom in went by and stopped, whom I can only describe in retrospect as vicious queens, and looked pityingly down, and one turned to the other and said, "Funnier than anything she did on the stage." It's always difficult finding stories under the letter Q, because there aren't many actors whose names begin with Q. Dennis Quilly, in this case, comes to our aid. Dennis Quilly is a wonderful, forthright, robust actor and singer. And he was in the National Theatre Company when Dr. Jonathan Miller cast him right against type as Sir Benjamin Backbite, the bitchy, sneering gossip in A School for Scandal. And Dennis, of course, like any actor would be, was terribly excited because he was not the obvious casting for this nasty piece of work. And he was very thrilled about it, thought it would show what range he had, threw himself into it, but he could find no point of sympathy, no point of identification with Sir Benjamin Backbite. And he got more and more worried about it, went home one night and said to his wife, Stella, "Look, I'm really getting nowhere with this part. I think I'll have to ask Jonathan to let me withdraw." And Stella said, "Well, have you spoken to Jonathan about it?" He said, "No, it seems so childish not to be able to do it myself." She said, "Well, go and talk to Jonathan. He cast you. Go and talk to him in the morning." So Dennis finally plucked up courage, and he went to Jonathan and said, "I really can't find anything, any sympathy with this bitchy, sneering, gossipy character." Jonathan thought for about 10 seconds and said, "Have you ever met Ned Sherrin?" And Dennis said, "Oh, yes, I understand entirely." Had no further problem with the characterisation. Briefly, under W, we've got Wuthering Heights. We've just had Sir Cliff as Heathcliff. I can remember when Sir Cliff Richard was happy to play Westcliff. But I did like the idea of the hit song, which apparently was "We're All Going on a Saga Holiday." We get now finally to Zed and Pia Zadora, curious American performer who had for a long time a rich husband and quite a lot of exposure, both as an actress and as a singer and indeed as a film star. But the story goes that she was in an off-Broadway production in a small theatre trying to make a serious career for herself in The Diary of Anne Frank. And apparently she was so absolutely appalling that on the first night, when the Gestapo in the climax of the play invade the flat, the entire audience rose as a man and yelled, "She's in the attic!" Thank you very much indeed.